Seventh chapter of Daniel. And we're going to be starting with verses 15 and 16 this evening. And as we begin, Randy, could I ask you to direct our minds in prayer?
Merciful Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. Thank you so much, Father, for all the wonderful things you've done for us and provided for us. Thank you for the opportunity that you've given us to gather together to study your word and to learn from your word, find out more of what you want from us, how you want us to live before you. We pray that you help us to understand the things that we read, help us to apply these things to our lives. Help us, Father, to be shining examples of those who believe. Please forgive us for our sins and strengthen our faith in Jesus.
Randy, I appreciate that prayer about understanding. The seventh chapter of Daniel here, especially the second half of this chapter, is difficult. And as I was explaining to Richard, it actually gave me somewhat of a headache and studying it and trying to analyze it, just like we see that the vision and the interpretation thereof kind of agitated Daniel's mind as well. So we're in the seventh chapter now, and we've left the first six chapters that really are about God's purpose and history. And now in chapters 7 through 12, these are the chapters that are prophetic in nature. They contain visions and prophecies. We have the vision we're going to continue to study about this evening in chapter 8. There's a vision of the ram and the goat. In chapter 9, we have the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And in chapters 10 through 12, we have a vision of the time of the end. Now, if you an easy way to remember what's in chapter 7 is that the first half of chapter 7 is about the vision itself. And the second half of the chapter, which we're going to try to cover this evening, is about the interpretation of that vision. Okay? So you have the vision and you have the interpretation of that vision. So now let's start. With kind of reviewing the second half of Daniel chapter 7. Daniel's troubled by the vision, and he asks for an interpretation, and he's told that the four beasts are four kings or kingdoms, that the saints of God or the Most High will take the kingdom and possess it forever and ever. After Daniel heard that explanation initially, Randy?
We kind of skipped over verse 16.
We're going to cover that.
Oh, okay.
No, that's okay.
Well, I was just wondering when he says those who were standing by, you just mentioned the
okay.
Interpretation.
And okay.
Right at the beginning of chapter 7, he's laying on his bed.
Yeah.
So those who were standing by must have been inside the vision.
Could have been, yes. Could have been. So Daniel's permitted a deeper look into the vision. And Daniel sees a horn making war with the saints until the ancient, and the horn is prevailing against the saints until the Ancient of Days came and gave judgment to the saints, and then the saints possessed the kingdom. And we're told that the fourth beast was the fourth kingdom, which was diverse from all others and would devour the earth. And tread it down and break it in pieces. And that the ten horns on the beast, on the fourth beast, were ten kings. Followed by another king, which would subdue three kings. And this one king would speak against God and wear out the saints given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time, and that judgment was set so that dominion would be taken away to consume and destroy until the end. And then the saints receive the kingdom, which is an everlasting kingdom. So it's kind of just a quick summary of the interpretation for Daniel. Now, as you go into a study of this last half, for this interpretation of the vision, the last half of chapter 7, it's a good idea to keep certain things in mind. For instance, that history has a chronological order. Who are these saints being talked about in the interpretation? When do these saints possess the kingdom? Who is, although we've already studied about this, who is the fourth beast or the fourth kingdom? Because your answers, or what you think about those questions, how you think about those questions, are going to drive how you analyze and interpret these verses about this vision. Okay, so in verses 15 and 16, "As for me, Daniel, my spirit was grieved in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things." So Daniel's kind of startled here. His mind is agitated over this vision. And it seems to give the idea here that Daniel's asking for, if you will, an authoritative interpretation of the vision. He wants to know the truth. Now, he asked one of those who stood by, and that was Randy's question from a moment ago. Who is, in verse 16, "I came near unto one of them that stood by." And, Randy, I agree with that they're probably part of the vision. Now, I don't know who they are, okay? Might have possibly, just as a suggestion, been an angel, okay? But other than that, I don't know who they are that stood by. John?
No problem. There was 10, there wasn't a shortage.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Okay. Richard?
Well, if we look at this, and if we were to say that this is somewhat of a parallel of the judgment seen in the book of Revelation.
Okay.
We see that not only are these ten thousands times ten thousands and myriads and things like that, it says that there were thrones placed. We see that in the book of Revelation it talks about that there were 24 elders, that there were a number mm-hmm. of other things going on around there. Now, just because he doesn't elucidate on that doesn't mean that it's not the same scene.
That's true. It could have been one of those individuals as well. Because there are a number of parallels in the imagery used in Daniel and the book of Revelation. Now,
I don't know whether this fits in right here, but
okay.
As we were discussing earlier, that I've been reading through the Kyle and Litzig commentary on this book of Daniel, and they're of the opinion that this judgment has to do with the judgment of the Jewish people of Israel. And I don't see how that fits at all. I mean, it doesn't seem to follow that this is because if that follows, then there's some sort of kingdom, everlasting kingdom being set up that has to do with the Jews and with Israel, not with what's actually going on here. We're talking about that these four kingdoms are being destroyed, at which time
right.
the Ancient of Days will set up an eternal kingdom.
Right.
And I think that's just so parallel to Daniel 2 and the things that are going on in Revelation that it would be difficult for these people to try and prove that this has something to do with the future of Israel
right.
between this time and the coming of the Messiah.
Right. Let's look at verse 17 here, okay? Everyone note verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings that shall arise out of the earth. Now look, what do we know from Daniel chapter 2 that we studied, specifically the 44th verse? Daniel 2, 44 says, doesn't it really say that God is going to set up an everlasting kingdom during the reign of the fourth kingdom there? That's what verse 44 is about. Now, don't verses 13 and 14 of this seventh chapter identify the same time frame? An everlasting kingdom, which is during the reign, here in the seventh chapter, of the fourth kingdom. In other words, let me go back to my earlier comment. One of the principles to think about as you're studying this chapter is history has a chronological order. Okay? Now look. If Daniel chapter 7 is identifying a certain time frame, and Daniel chapter 2 is identifying the same time frame, it's only reasonable to conclude that the four beasts in Daniel chapter 7 are the four kingdoms in Daniel chapter 2. As we've looked at the charts for the last couple of Wednesday evenings. And let's note that, well, if we look at in the first chapter of Luke at about verses 30 through maybe 32 or 33, we see that Jesus came to establish the kingdom. In the fourth chapter of Matthew, around verse 17, Jesus preached that the kingdom was near. In Mark chapter 9 and verse 1, the kingdom was going to come in the lifetime, during the lifetime of that particular generation. And in Acts 2 and about verse 36, Peter preached that Christ has been made, or that Jesus has been made both Lord and Christ. And we see from the book of Colossians in chapter 1 about verses 11, 12, and 13. Now, from that time forward, from the time of Pentecost forward, men entered the kingdom. Now, the point is this. When did all those events occur? When did they occur? They occurred, if we would look at the third chapter of Luke, I believe, about verse 1, they occurred during the days of the Roman emperors. Okay? We see the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecies here, these dreams about the fourth kingdom. This fulfillment we see in all of these events that we're talking about, the events that lead up to the establishment of the kingdom in Acts chapter 2. All of these events occurred during the time, during the reign of the fourth kingdom. So we're identifying this fourth kingdom here, or this fourth beast, as the Roman Empire. Roy? Okay. Now, in verse 18, this is where the second half of the chapter maybe starts to get a little more difficult. It says, "But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever." Okay. Now it says, "But the saints shall receive the kingdom." So we're talking about something that's going to happen in the future here. So who might these saints be? Randy?
Well, the saints are holy ones. Saints are those who are set apart in the service of God. I'm thinking Christians, but maybe I'm jumping the gun because you were saying that all this takes place before the destruction of Jerusalem.
Well, okay. Well, let's keep in mind that history has chronological order. Okay? Let's see. Who had their hand up first? Roy?
Well, that's what I was going to ask before you got to verse 18 here. Excuse me. The saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom. When that happens, the kingdom... When was the kingdom established? Is that when Jesus died or when he came back?
Acts chapter 2.
Okay, so what you're asking is who receives it? Who are the saints you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm saying who are these saints? Yes.
The saints are the people that are ruled by Jesus Christ.
Pardon me? Okay. Okay. So you're answering that the saints are New Testament Christians. David?
I think those that had been faithful under the patriarchal law, the law of Moses, didn't have Christ around. So, but his blood went back all the way to the beginning of time. So I would think it was those in the past.
Okay, the death of Christ, when Christ shed his blood, That blood reached back, didn't it? Because Christ died once for all. Not just for everybody on this side of the cross, but let's notice here that we're going to maybe take this a little bit out of order, but we got to remember that part of the vision has it has this horn, which we'll talk about later on, making war against the saints. Prior to the saints possessing the kingdom. Okay? Now underline that in your minds, prior to. Now, Roy? Sorry, Daryl. Okay. What? Yeah, Randy, can you remember your last comment?
No, I basically just said the same thing that was already said.
Yeah. Okay, now, the word that's translated saints here six times in the seventh chapter of Daniel is, and Richard, for you, that's Strong's number 6922. Okay? That is, if I can pronounce it right, Kaddish. And it simply means holy or separate. Okay? Now the question is there anything in the passage here, anything in here that demands that the word saint here be applied to New Testament Christians? Richard.
I would say if you just look up the English word in the Old Testament, saint. The American Standard Version, the word saints is used 29 times, starting off in Deuteronomy, the 33rd chapter, where Moses calls the people of God saints. So this word, Kaddish, talking about holy ones, is the same essential translation as the Greek word for saint. It just means
right.
Holy, set apart one.
Yeah, holy, separate, set apart one. Now, so we haven't found anything yet that demands, okay, that these saints here in verse 18 are New Testament saints only. Again, let's keep in mind that these same saints are going to be warred against prior to them possessing the kingdom. That's what the vision says. Joey? Right.
And the criteria for that would be whether or not God deems you faithful to the law that you live under.
Well, now,
if you lived under the patriarchal law and you were faithful to it, then you would be a saint. If you lived under the law of Moses and you were faithful in it, you would be a saint. If you live under the New Testament law and you're faithful in it, God would consider you a saint. You'd be sanctified as long as you're faithful to the law that you live under.
Now, for instance, if we think about Acts 2 and verse 5, there were devout Jews there on that day of Pentecost in Jerusalem. But I suspect that they didn't all show up on that same day there on the day of Pentecost. That those devout Jews were existing there in Jerusalem before the day of Pentecost. Okay? John was baptizing, a baptism unto repentance. Jesus baptized also, didn't he? Okay. Now, Daryl? Yes.
So when Jesus died, his testament,
exactly. That's right.
He didn't show up, still had to obey the law of liberty and all that.
Yes, those devout Jews in the time period we're talking about still had to be baptized. Okay. We're going to come back to this about who these saints are, but perhaps these saints are of the Old Testament variety, if I can phrase it that way. Okay? Randy?
You had mentioned, you know, what is in the passage that might
demand
that it be New Testament Christian.
Right.
The only thing I'm thinking of is in verse 14, that to him was given dominion, glory, and the kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language,
mm-hmm.
which would rule out just Israel, because Israel is not made up of peoples, nations, and men of every language.
That's true.
But in the vision, we're not, the part we're reading right now, 15 and on, is the explanation of the vision, so it's not like we're back at the beginning of it.
Right.
Now maybe chronologically, this other is at the end.
You have to reconcile that with the part of the vision that says these saints are being warred against prior to possessing the kingdom.
Right, so what I was thinking was perhaps, you know, Jesus had many disciples as he walked and taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3 years, 3.5 years of ministry, followed by
right.
days of the resurrected Christ teaching. Servants of the Almighty King before the kingdom was established.
Now, let's see, before I lose my place here in the 18th verse, we'll in a few more verses, we'll come back to these same saints who were going to be warred against, and then they were going to possess the kingdom. And that word possess there, and Richard, that's Strong's number 2631.
Thank you.
Possess means to hold in occupancy. So these saints were going to occupy something. Okay, they're going to occupy the kingdom. Now, in verse 19, then I desired to know the truth concerning the fourth beast, which was diverse from all of them, exceeding terrible, whose teeth were of iron, and its nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with its feet. Now, we've already started to identify this fourth beast here as Rome. Now, I've kind of put together some historical descriptions of Rome from literature, and they include statements such as Rome was singularly voracious, cruel, and destructive, even vindictive as a world power. She could never get enough of conquest. Often she conquered just out of sheer spiteful vengeance. Rome had no interest in raising the conquered nations to any high level of development. All her designs were exploitation and imperialism. If they could not devour a victim by plunder and taxation, they would stamp it under their feet, sacked and burned, left in desolate ruins. And you know what? When you study the history of Rome, That's certainly what Rome did to Carthage. The Romans completely destroyed Carthage, even going to the extent of plowing up the earth and laying down salt so nothing else would grow there. And what did Rome do to Jerusalem? What did Jesus say was going to happen? Down to the last stone, to the last brick. Now, these descriptions from recorded secular history certainly fit with the description of this different kind of beast from the other three in verse 19. And, you know, by the way, let me give you just a little hint. You know, all of a sudden here you see that the vision, this vision of four beasts, all of a sudden we're skipping, you might say, to the fourth kingdom. That could be because in some future chapters, there may be some visions about the other beasts. So just keep that in mind for your future study. Richard?
I was going to say, and I don't know if this follows a pattern of history or not, but when we look at the description of the Babylonian Empire and then later on the Medo-Persian Empire and how it treated the Jews, you know, obviously they destroyed their cities and they took them away prisoner, but when they were back in their kingdom in Babylon or in the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, they were treated sort of like citizens. They were given a place. You know, they may have been a lower class, but it appears that they had certain amounts of freedom. I mean, we can see in the book of Esther about how the people, you know, had a certain amount of freedom and had a certain amount of say-so in the court and things like that. Yet, when we look at biblical descriptions of Rome, we see that so many people get upset because Herod took and washed his hands of Jesus. Pilate.
Mm-hmm.
Washed his hands of Jesus. But the fact of the matter is that if you really look in the Gospels and see how the Romans treated the Jews, they treated them as subhuman. They didn't consider them to be people worthy of being treated like they were.
Certainly they didn't treat them like people, conquered peoples were treated in the Persian Empire, where they were incorporated and made part of the empire. The Jews had quite a bit of freedom, actually, in the Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. So Rome, you would say, is the opposite of that. But so we kind of skip to the fourth beast in this vision. And then there's another part of the description of this fourth beast in verse 20. And concerning the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three fell, even that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake great things, whose look was more stout than its fellows. Now let's just make a short comment about verse 20 here, that what we see happening to this beast is it has ten horns and three fall, and the emergence of one stout looking horn. We see kind of a change or a transformation here going on regarding this fourth beast. Now, in verse 21, I beheld, and the same horn, so this one horn, stout looking horn, made war with the saints and prevailed against them. Now we spent some time a couple minutes ago talking about how there were Old Testament saints. Okay? And again, this word here, saints, in verse 21 is the same word, kaddish, simply means holy or separate. There's nothing in the context here that we can pick out that says these are New Testament saints in verse 21. And notice in verse 22, this horn was making war and prevailed against them, prevailed against the saints, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. Now notice, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Okay. Let me suggest to you that the saints here could not possess a kingdom until that kingdom came into existence. Right? And when did the kingdom come into existence? Acts chapter 2. But notice, this little horn is making war and prevailing against the saints before they possessed, before they came into the kingdom. Now, verses 23 and 24 are going to kind of tie a lot of this together. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom shall ten kings arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the former, and he shall put down three kings. Now remember, we've been trying to establish, Jonathan.
Is this going to tie back into the statement about until the Ancient of Days came, judgment was given to the saints of the Most High?
Eventually, yes.
Okay. That sets a lot of context to it too, doesn't it?
Yes. Especially, I believe, for some late verses towards the end of the chapter. We've been trying to establish that this fourth beast or this fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire. Now, let's try to make this image of ten horns and three horns and one horn. How can we make that fit recorded chronological history? Okay, when we go back to the beginning of Rome, approximately 500 BC or a little earlier, up until 100 BC, Rome was ruled by a senate. Rome was ruled or governed by a multiplicity of senators. Now, 10 here on this beast just might represent the idea of a multiplicity here. And certainly the senate was a multiplicity of rulers. Now, after 100 BC, the Senate, for a number of reasons, became weak in its power, and an individual appeared on the scene by the name of Julius Caesar. And he formed a coalition with two other Romans, one named Crassus and one named Pompey. And it got to the point in Rome where Caesar and Pompey and Crassus ruled Rome. Now there are three right there, and in history that was called the Triumvirate. And then around 50 or 48, 47 BC or so, by the time we get to that point in history, both Crassus and Pompey had died, and that left Julius Caesar. He was in control of Rome. And in 44 BC, Caesar was assassinated by the Senate. And then, after Caesar's assassination, guess what? Three other individuals rose to prominence. One by the name of Lepidus, Mark Antony, and Octavius, who is going to be later known as Augustus Caesar. And Octavius became the power in Rome. He became emperor of Rome. So what we have, what I believe we have here is a vision of the evolution of the government of the Fourth World Empire, specifically the evolution from a republic to an emperor or a Caesar. Now, there are a lot of people out there that want to take some positions where they actually name specific individuals. And I'm not saying that the little horn is Julius Caesar or Octavius Augustus, okay? I'm saying that this is pictorial language and it symbolizes a transition of the government of the Fourth World Empire. For instance, some people want to say that one of these horns was actually the Roman Emperor Domitian. yeah, Tommy?
Well, I agree that there's no language that demands it be the first century Christians. I also don't think it's any language saying it can't be. And I'd like for us all to look at that a little bit and come back next week. Because when did Rome war against the saints? Before the church came, before the persecution where Rome was terrorizing Christians in the book of Revelation was written, I really don't know that we can say that the fourth beast was ravaging the saints until that time. And then God's judgment, I believe here in the book of Revelation, came and destroyed the fourth beast of the Roman Empire and made everybody see that God's dominion would be forever.
You're talking about a particular time period of the Roman Empire from the time of Nero to Constantine, from around 63 or 65 BC up to 310 or so AD. Yeah. I meant to say 63 or 64 AD to 313 or 310 AD. That's in particular as a period of time, as you're pointing out, where Rome was warring against the saints. But then remember that the scriptures here seem to indicate that this fourth beast was warring against the saints before they possessed the kingdom. Now, like I said, this chapter is not easy. Tommy?
Which could mean that they didn't possess the kingdom forever and ever until they had served faithfully until death, as we read in Revelation 2:10. And then they possessed the kingdom forever. But in the New Testament, after the church was established in Acts chapter 2, there were several times, in Ephesians 4 it talks about it, that the kingdom was given to man at that time, and so the kingdom has already been given. So the saints are members and fellow citizens of the kingdom.
Right. But I believe what we, Richard?
Well, I was going to say is that when we look at this and we look at the definition of the word saints, we can see that the Roman Empire obviously persecuted the Old Testament saints for their religious beliefs before the establishment of the church in Acts, the second chapter. I mean, all you have to do is look at Antiochus Epiphanes who came in and desecrated the temple and tried to get them to put pigs in the temple sort of stuff. And so the saints of God, in other words, the people that were set apart by God, that were faithful Jews at that time, they were, and of course other people, were persecuted by the Romans at that time and were persecuted physically for their religious beliefs up until the time and after the time that fifth kingdom was established, the one that destroyed the other.
That's right. But let's try to avoid, using this pictorial language as some have used to say that one of these specific horns is Julius Caesar and one is the Emperor Domitian, so on and so forth. Because we're starting to come close here to picking and choosing what's pictorial and what is literal when we start doing that. That's it? Okay. Thank you very much.